Welcome back to another ICC episode. It's been a long time coming, but we are back. I'm here with Mona Qasemi, the Vice President of the Iranian Canadian Congress. Mona is a software developer who has an extensive background in the social sciences. Mona, thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Daniel, for having me. It's an honor.
My pleasure. Mona, what was your motivation when you decided to run to become the ICC president?
Well, I have been sort of involved in, political sort of activities over the, over the course of my last few years in university. I'm a very much social justice oriented. I was involved in, I had volunteered for the Cooper Concordia, which is a Quebec public interest research group, involved in, sort of managing the funding for these various research groups that were doing activist work, as well as I had been involved in the Center for Gender Advocacy. And as I guess we're going to come to, since I am Iranian Canadian, it makes sense to also participate in the Iranian Canadian Congress, which I believe is doing some good work trying to improve the relations between Iran and Canada and improve the lives of Iranians living in Canada.
Well, that's interesting because, we talk about, I think we tend to talk about things like, for me, complicated concept like Iranian, Canadian, but when we explore these topics, they often tend to be more complex than they seem. What is an Iranian? What is a Canadian? Can they coexist together in one single word? So, but before going into that, Mona, I'd really love to hear a little bit about your background because, as I, read through your bio, you are a very diverse person. And I think it'd be very interesting to, get a little background about, where you were born, perhaps if that's important, right? And where you were born and where you were raised, and what's your maybe academic background and what's your worldview in general? Give us a little spiel.
Big questions, worldview. they used to call me well-rounded in high school. I was always interested in all the subjects, and I had no idea what I wanted to be when I grew up. I think my elementary school yearbook says that I wanted to be a scientist, and it was like that general, right? A very general. Now I'm more of a social scientist in terms of having a master's in anthropology. But I also have a bachelor's in computer science, and I landed in the private sector technology field. But it's not really my passion. It's more a way to pay the bills while I try to do the work that I think is worthwhile, which currently is mostly with the Iranian Canadian Congress. And as I mentioned, I've done other volunteer work in the past.
That's fantastic. Why do you identify as an Iranian Canadian, if I may ask?
Right. Well, I was born in Iran and I was raised in Canada since the age of two. So I'm, sort of quintessentially, I can't, some people will tell me, and people have told me when they realize that I was living in Canada for so long, they say, oh, well, you're Canadian. I don't really have that perspective because my growing up was very much affected by the identity that my parents brought, the culture that my parents brought with them when they arrived in Canada. We were mostly surrounded by other Iranian Canadians, and that was, my parents or my family friend group growing up. I was raised with the Iranian culture, Islamic Iranian culture, Shia culture, and it affected my interactions with other people. I did, I wore the hijab until I was 25 years old. And that is 100% going to affect how everybody interacts with you. Yeah, I have like maybe some experiences relating to that specifically. But also, just I wasn't a Canadian citizen until, I think until I was 17, 18, or maybe a bit older than that. I don't remember anymore, but this also sort of affected my perception, but also the way I experienced living in Canada.
Absolutely. So perhaps there is a part of you that, makes you unique in a sense that, you were born in Iran, and the fact that you didn't get your citizenship until you were 15 or 14. I suppose that would affect your politics, how people view you and how you view the world, having a family that's perhaps a Persian speaker at home and maybe an English speaker. So I assume your story might resonate with a lot of other Iranian Canadians, maybe first or second generation who were born mostly in Canada or raised mostly in Canada.
Yeah, I tend to, I mean there I guess there is my sort of friend group of Iranians that I grew up with, Iranian Canadians I should say. But I think everyone's experience is unique, so it's never 100% right. But there is such diversity in the Iranian Canadian community. I guess you can say that of any diasporic community, but Iranians specifically, because there were so many different waves of immigration, the experience is very different. And people's relationship to each country is highly affected by, exactly at what point they migrated and what were the reasons for the migration. So there's a lot of diversity there, and it's really interesting.
And
Yeah, and sorry, go
go
ahead.
ahead, continue, please.
Well, I was going to say that, like, I think that we tend to be viewed in a rather monolithic way, both, Iran, the home country, and but also, like, I think that just the way the media portrays us, and the way people see us, they tend to expect a certain worldview that is not necessarily always the case. Yeah.
Do you think the media in general, I mean, having grown up mostly in Canada, do you think society at large projects a certain view of you as an Iranian Canadian person, and they expect you to live up to that perspective, to that image? And, do you think that creates some kind of problems for you as a person? Does it create stresses, anxieties?
Yeah, so let me take it back to the hijab as a specific example, right?
Yes.
So I, while I was wearing the hijab, people had a certain pe perspective and expectation of me. When I stopped wearing the hijab, sometimes, just like I told you, I would occasionally tell people, yeah, I used to wear the hijab, for many years. One time, I don't know what the context was that I felt that I need to bring it up, but I mentioned it to a stranger on the bus, on the public bus system. sometimes I get in conversations with strangers. That's just my personality, I guess. But it was, I think it was a Quebecois man, and the immediate reaction is, oh, good for you. And this made me very angry. Because I don't, you see, there's a certain perspective of the hijab specifically as being oppressive, and you can take that as a bigger symbol for, maybe Islamic societies in general. Iran specifically has a very negative view in the media due to just the way it's portrayed. Every time they tell a story about Iran, it's, you know, there's a woman in a black chador just, you know, walking by. And that's the perspective that people have of Iran. And more, yeah. Go ahead, you can feel free.
I just no, I relate to that. I mean, I've had in my own interactions as well. I've noticed that too. You know, as soon as you say, you know, you're Persian or you're Iranian Canadian, the entire interaction changes often. And and you're sometimes, I wonder if this is the case with you. Do you find yourself playing into those stereotypes that say society or other people have for you? For example, say, I don't know, a hijabi Muslim woman, or, you know, based on your previous experience, say a hijabi person. Do you play into those stereotypes and those stereotypes that people place on you? If so, how? And then secondly, how do you navigate this? How do you overcome this at all? If you think overcoming it would be a good thing to do.
Yeah, I absolutely try not to fall into the, you know, I'm not trying to fool anybody. I'm not trying to play a role. I'm usually trying to be my authentic self. And yes, my authentic self tends to be quite different from what people expect. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to. I'm sorry. I kind of lost my train of thought for a second.
That's
there.
Okay.
But I'm trying to. I do try to challenge people's perspective when I encounter sort of these stereotypical views.
Yes.
I try to explain things to them. Sometimes people are not receptive. I find that very often they will try to, they have their own existing perception and they will project that onto whatever they do hear from you. So if you say something confirming their existing bias that, you know, Iran is an oppressive society, like these blanket statements, then, you can make a statement about a certain experience you had and that will play into the stereotype.
Exactly.
And if you come and challenge that, they will also twist it in a certain way. So I find it very difficult to navigate that in terms of, like, if you meet a stranger and start having a conversation with them, it can be often very difficult.
Of course. I find, as you know, identity is something that's always evolving. We might be somebody, we're constantly changing. Cultures are constantly changing. I like what you said, that, you know, we're not this monolith. We're not this monolithic culture or identity that we all should share the same kind of cultural patterns, cultural practices, but that, you know, identity always changes, much like cultures do. And I can see that somehow in you and in your work, you seem to have changed quite a bit over the time. And it almost seems like you're constantly evolving yourself as a way of challenging these normative identity construct that's been imposed on you, whether it be, let's say, by, you know, notions of Iranian culture, or say Canadian expectation of what an Iranian should be, or Iranian expectation of what a Iranian should be. You seem to have this urge in you to challenge these normative constructs. I got the feeling. I don't know. Maybe you want to tell me about that.
My mother once called me that, she said that I rebel for the sake of rebellion. I don't know how true it is. I think I rebel because I think there's a reason to rebel. I don't like being put in a box. I don't like, I think that my entire childhood I was put in a box. And, you know, you've been reading my thesis. That was a very personal journey for me in terms of choosing that topic and choosing to pursue that as and I used to joke that this is therapy, you know, this, when I was doing my when I was doing my interviews and my research, I would tell to my classmates, yeah, this is my therapy. Don't tell that to my supervisor, but that's why I'm doing it. I don't know if she would have complained. She was a very nice feminist lady. Sally Cole, she's retired now from Concordia.
We're going to get to that. We're going to get to the thesis.
But I think, you know, growing up being told that certain action, certain way of behavior are appropriate, certain ways of behavior are not appropriate, in a way that was quite limiting to my freedom and joy in life. I think that made me, maybe that led to me questioning all of it. You know, I definitely had a period, you know, when I was 17, 18, where I was questioning everything. And trying to sort of rebuild my philosophy from the ground up. And, you know, there have been different iterations of that. I think hopefully I'm at a good place now in terms of, still searching. I still don't know who Mona is, but, you know.
Well, it's more tricky, I find, Mona, right? I mean, you had to navigate all these different identity, let's say, constructs, you know. Hijab, being in Iran, having been born in Iran, you know, even let's say gender norms, you know, what these gender expectations place on. And then, you know, having to live in Canada, right? And from what you were telling me, you didn't fully feel Canadian either, because you were kind of an outsider at the same time while
very
being
much
also
so,
an insider. So this gave you, and I think this gives a lot of, let's say, Iranian Canadian second or first generation, or people who have lived in Canada most of their lives, an interesting perspective to life, right? And in many ways, even though, you know, it might be very difficult to navigate these norms, navigate these identities, but it also gives you an advantage, don't you think? I mean, do you think that these politics also motivated you towards social justice? You know, that maybe perhaps that's why you have this thirst towards social justice.
Yeah, it definitely gives me a different perspective. And having, when I was on the board at Cooper Concordia, we had some trainings, and I don't remember what the general purpose of the training was, but we had to draw a tree representing sort of our roots and what it was that, you know, motivated us.
Right.
And, you know, I've definitely put in there, you know, my, you know, being raised Muslim in Canada. And and I think that in some way that gave me a strong motivating background. I was very religious growing up, less so now, you know. But I think certain practices, you know, for example, let's say Ramadan. I practice Ramadan. I continue to practice Ramadan. And I think it can give people such strength, because you can overcoming the barriers, or not barriers, sorry, I misspoke, more so the nafs, right?
Right.
The carnal desire, let's say, or your very basic needs, right? But you can overcome. You don't eat. Yes, you're hungry, but you can wait, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
This is a very powerful thing that, you know, some people, there are other people who do all kinds of challenges and pay a lot of money to go somewhere for somebody to train them, like kind of a military structure to be strong, right?
Yes.
But
yes.
We have these practices within our religious tradition that are helping us in those life challenges by providing that kind of discipline that can help us in other challenges in life. So, you know, I had a recent conversation with an individual who, we talked about religion. I don't remember exactly how it started, but she told me I was being very defensive whenever my religion specifically was brought up, and it turned out she was saying, no, religion is bad, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of, you know,
sure.
blanket, and you're not willing to admit it, and that's intellectually dishonest of you. I unfortunately, she was no longer interested in the conversation, and I wasn't
well,
able to like continue with that, but I completely wholeheartedly disagree. I think, you know, there are certain aspects, and I don't want to, you know, as a cultural anthropologist, I'm very careful with this. My thesis is very critical of certain, let's say, impositions
mm-hmm.
that I think, you know, have more to do with patriarchy than with religion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that attribution is kind of important to, you know, try to be careful about, right? Because
mm-hmm.
there's all kinds of ways of practicing religion. There's all kinds of ways of practicing Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, we can't make that blanket statement and saying, you know, Islam is bad, you know.
Agreed.
And of course I have to be defensive because I'm living in a world that is attacking me because of that identity.
Exactly,
and,
right.
Yeah.
Of course, and I think you felt that all your, let me ask you this. Did you feel this sense of being attacked? And you use the word attacked, but you know, having at some point identified yourself as a practicing Muslim or practicing Muslim Iranian, no less. Did you ever felt that you were attacked in, let's say, in the Canadian society, have been raised up in, let's say, a secular culture, the university secular culture, or I don't know, like just growing up in Canada? Did you ever felt like that?
So I think the first example that came to mind was when I was in high school, right after September 11th, like just,
oh,
I think it was probably the same day,
oh,
like because maybe the teachers were seeing the news and you know, there were rumors floating around, you know, we didn't have internet yet, you know, there might've been internet on the school laptops, but nobody had a smartphone, but this
sure.
kid came up to me and was just like, you're a terrorist,
wow.
You know, and it was kind of jarring, right? And I remember, and I think this was kind of the first big incident, you know, obviously, you know, it was a major world shifting event, right?
Yes.
And we hadn't had a big attack like that in the Western world, I think, or, you know, at least, yeah, that was, you know, it was unique.
Yes, say the
in
least.
The scope and
right.
Right?
Yes.
But even prior to that, I had grown up kind of, I had these magazines. Now, I don't know, you know, I don't know if I necessarily, you know, endorsed them, but there was a Young Muslim magazine, which I think is published by you know, Muslim Brotherhood, not Muslim Brotherhood,
yes.
Sorry, I think I might be misspeaking.
Maybe Nation of Islam?
Nation of Islam, I believe so, sorry.
Farrukhan. Maybe
I think that Muslim Brotherhood might be a different thing. So excuse me if I misspoke. I think it is Nation of Islam, and so I grew up reading these. You know, I think it's my father had a friend, you know, who had them, and there were stories, kind of, you know, comic book type of stories of exactly Muslim, young Muslim characters being criticized of being a terrorist. You know, I was like, what's a terrorist? You know, you know, I had to ask my parents what a terrorist is,
sure.
Because, you know, somebody thought it was important to inform young Muslims that they were going to go out into the world and people were going to call them terrorists.
Sure.
And of course,
Wow.
that did end up happening to me, right?
Wow. Wow. Yes.
And, you know, it's very strange, right? Because we know that, like, obviously none of us endorse that, and yet we are lumped into this. As I said before, there are these stereotypes and these kind of broad generalizations, because you're wearing hijab,
Yes.
you must be on the side of,
I
these
think,
attackers who like
yes.
have no relationship to.
Of course. And you know, as may I, how old were you, for example, when 9/11 when that happened, when you went through those?
2011, I would have been 12 years old.
And I was going to mention, these interactions, people calling you terrorists, and then you turn on the TV, it's, demonization 24/7, and then you just start, at some point you start internalizing this, you're saying, well, this the world sees me as this, but I don't feel like that, right? But this creates a conflict naturally between how you see yourself and how potentially, you think the others view you as. So this must have been a very traumatic experience for you, and I'm sure it's a very traumatic experience for many people such as yourself who've grown up in Canada as, second or first generation Iranian Canadian during that time, especially.
It has been many years, right? So I don't have too many vivid experience of that. But if we look at the statistics, I know for sure the anti-Muslim hate crime was going up. I feel like I remember
Right,
that.
I understand.
I did start, I think I had one t-shirt that said New York on it, and I started wearing that to school, on the anniversary and things like that. So I guess, there, I guess there's a little bit of performative,
Of course,
in
yeah,
there,
you want to
but
be accepted. That's just perfectly normal. So again, as you know, Mona, cultures or identity in general are things that we adopt. We constantly adopt different systems, different identities as a way to survive in the world, as a way to know ourselves and make sense of the world. So it's perfectly natural to, adopt fads or fashions or cultural instruments to make ourselves fit in, even to survive in a society. But that's what makes your life particularly interesting, because you have this reservoir of cultural identity that you can borrow from, right? And then you can also, you also were in a society that you kind of felt hostility towards some of your identities that you have chosen to embrace. But that led you on a journey of self-discovery, of questioning, which you're still on, presumably. Tell me about your university experience and your master's degree, and you wrote a thesis, and it's an ethnography, which I had a pleasure of reading. It reads really well. It reads like a true ethnography, which I'm a fan of. First of all, explain to us what an ethnography is, and how can we use ethnography, the anthropological method of making sense of these identities, cultural identities.
Daniel, can you just give me a moment? I just need
Oh,
to,
sure. Okay, thanks for that little pause, Mona. Welcome back. Just before you left, we were just about to delve into your area of research in your thesis. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what your thesis was about, what motivated you, and what were some of the conclusions you drew from your thesis?
But first you asked me what is ethnography, right?
Correct. But I
So
mean, because in your thesis, based on what I read of your thesis, you were using the anthropological method. And as you know, anthropological method utilizes a lot of participatory observation or
Yes.
participatory field work and ethnography. Tell us a little bit about them, first of all, and then you can tell us a little bit about your research.
Right. So when I got into anthropology, I did I did a bachelor's in computer science, and then I shifted towards that
Yes,
direction. I had already been
very
exposed
interesting.
to anthropology in Asia, and for me that was kind of let's say triggered a thought process, because I learned about cultural relativism.
Sure,
My
yes.
whole life I'd been told that this one thing is right, that's what you do. And then I was exposed to this idea that every culture makes sense in its own context, right?
Exactly. Good point.
So Yeah, so with ethnography, what we try to do is we try to embed ourselves in the societies we're studying and try to live the way the people we're studying live. You know, in the past, of course, anthropology has kind of, questionable origins in terms of how it was used in colonialism. And, it was normally used to study the other, right? The people who are not us, right? They're other than us. And but these anthropologists would go out and embed themselves in these societies, and they would do very detailed studies of exactly what the people ate, what all their practices were, and they would try to come up with a, what they call emic explanation as opposed to etic. Emic being from the inside as opposed to etic being from the outside. So, we try to continue that tradition within the more contemporary anthropological work. And of course it has shifted a lot because there's a lot of question about who is the other now, and especially we're living in a much more globalized world, right? But more and more so people do go and study sort of their own societies in a way. And in this, in the sense of being as myself a hyphenated identity, it's, I am somewhat of an outsider,
It comes
but
naturally to you, in other words. In other words,
right.
you were always, you see, you, it seems that you felt like an outsider on the outset with your childhood. So you've always had this insider-outsider perspective to begin with.
Always, yes. So, my goal was to actually do ethnographic research in Iran. Unfortunately, that did not work out with the timing. I was at Concordia University. There was a big scandal. Mahmoud Farah was on my, advisory board, and she got arrested right before I was planning on doing my. I had already booked my plane ticket to go to Iran and do research there, and the
Politics.
university was like, no. We don't want you going there and getting into this conundrum just in case, you've been in her emails and whatnot. So didn't happen. And then I had to do it in Canada, which was kind of a lot more difficult. So my research did end up being largely interview based, and I was still doing, I was still doing trying to go to different cultural centers where I would meet a lot of Iranians. I had my, my own community, but I tried to expand out into, other centers. I went to sort of like, I don't know, a feminist group of Iranian feminist center, and just, went to one of their sessions, and I would go to, a few different mosques. But it was another maybe cultural center, language school, and I would go to these and I would meet people there, but it did end up largely being interview based just because of the situation that I found myself in. Right. So, I still had to live in my own apartment and, continue to live the way I was living. So it was, it, you know, it felt less embedded, right? But, of course I can sort of transpose that, or combine that with my experience of travels to Iran, but it's not really the same thing. But I think you were asking what more specifically about what my research
Yeah, I mean,
was.
you did the ethnography. I mean, even though okay, so this is just my perspective before we move on. Even though you weren't able to necessarily go to Iran, do your research, do your field work in Iran, but you were embedded in the Iranian Canadian community,
Yeah,
in its own,
and then that's what it's
in
focused on,
and of
is on, yeah.
itself. You already had this extensive insider perspective of the Iranian Canadian, if you can call it a culture, even though, as you say, it's not a monolith. There's so many different varieties within Iran, I mean, but within the Iranian Canadian community. And when I was reading your thesis, it read really well. The ethnography was really well done. And I could tell throughout the whole thing, you mentioned that it was kind of therapy for you too. Throughout the whole thing, this had somehow a reflection of your own being, of your own embeddedness within the Iranian Canadian culture, and how you make sense of your positionality within the context of this community, being an Iranian. How do you make sense of being an Iranian, you know, all these different identity, your gender, your religion, your sense of self within the Canadian context. But yeah, please explore it. Tell us a little bit. I mean, what motivated you towards doing that kind of research? And, you know, what was your research more or less about?
Right. So, you know, I guess if I start from the therapy side of it, I had to figure out why my parents were so mean to me. And I concluded...
One question, was it just your parents or also just your interaction with society at large too?
You know, obviously I'm saying that in a humorous way. I think in my experience, it was, you know, what I was trying to get at was the way my parents interacted with me in relation to how I was supposed to interact with the rest of society, if that makes sense. You know, there were certain activities that I was not allowed to partake in, you know.
Sure. Yes, of course. Yeah.
Let me give you like kind of a silly example. I was in high school, you know, my friends, a group of you know, kids from high school, we wanted to go on a bike ride, we take our bikes and go riding around, I don't know where, but that was the plan, you know, after
sure.
school someday.
Yeah, we're for a bike ride. Yeah.
And you know, my dad, you know, I was telling my parents that I wanted to go on a bike ride with a group of, you know, kids from school.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad came all the way to the school and said, okay, I'll come with you.
Oh, no.
I said, of course, no, you know, no teenager would ever want that. You know, now you're the odd one out.
Yes.
With your, you know, helicopter parent, you know, mm-hmm. nobody, you know, none of the other kids want the other parents around. It, you know, you're kind of infringing on the sense of freedom and independence that you're trying to grow into as a teenager. And, because there was one boy in this group, my dad said, no, you can't go.
Right.
You know, either I come along or you can't go. And so,
yes,
and that was that was quite upsetting to me, you know, and I had been following all the rules, you know, that my parents had set out. And, you know, obviously that wasn't the only event where I had this kind of struggle, but you're trying to fit in, you know, from childhood, and you know, especially as a teenager, right? And you know, you can't. So you know, I was aware that you know, my sort of cultural or religious upbringing was a little stricter in terms of the gender, I would say. Gender segregation, you know, was quite strong. Being a from a religious Iranian community,
and it leads. I mean, it goes back to what you were telling me. You know, you had to meet all these expectations. What your family expected of you, what society expected you, what your friend. So again, it goes back to this complexity of identity, especially as an Iranian Canadian. This body politics and this politics that just as your identity, you have to navigate, which is, you know, really complex, really interesting. But continue, please.
Yeah. So, and so, you know, I was very, you know, as a teenager, I was, you know, upset about all these things. And then I was trying to figure out what was the reason for it. And I came to the conclusion that it was all about virginity. You know, it was about enforcing this holy, you know, sort of holy grail of what a proper, you know, Muslim marriageable woman is, right? And so that became the center of what I was trying to get at with my thesis. You know, I played with a few different topics and I came to this one, and, you know, You know, my thesis supervisor, Sally Cole, she has a lot of you know, experience sort of with feminist anthropology, but
yes,
Homa was the one who you know, had more of a context with Iran, and she was you know, she was able to say that yes, this is a topic that, you know, there hasn't been that much research on that specifically, and so I wanted to get into that. And you know, I had sort of varied results in terms of, like, when I started to talk to people, I thought, oh, this is, you know, this is going to come out somehow. I can, you know, I can ask questions about their childhoods and about marriage and about, you know, various life stages, and it'll come out somehow. And with some people, hardly at all, you know. So I said, okay, maybe they had a bit of a different experience, but there were a few women who knew exactly what I was trying to get at, and they gave it to me. And,
so I guess from what I understood very briefly, what your experience was and what your, you know, what a lot of your studies showed based on your interviews and your, you know, participatory field work, it indicated to me that this notion of, you know, guarding sexual purity, especially among women, is it has been traditionally used as a tool of oppression, but it wasn't necessarily an outcome of Islam per se, but it's a long-standing institution. And you even mentioned, you know, it has its roots in even in the context of Iran, let's say, in pre-Islamic Iranian society as well. But nevertheless, you know, you pointed this out. And,
yeah, I don't remember the scholar, but there was a scholar, I believe I cited, who referred to the patriarchal belt, which includes China. You know, there's just, you know, there were a few scattered matriarchal societies here and there, but you know, this, you know, I talk about sort of hymenoplasty and other tools that are now on the market for women who want to ensure that they have the supposed non-medical physical, you know, bleeding on the first intercourse. So there are, and so these, you know, these things we can see that they, you know, they exist in China, they exist in Iran as well, Turkey, Arab countries. So it's quite a vast swathe of countries, but you know, it's not rooted in Islam at all, and it is rooted more so
in patriarchy as a system. I understand. And you know, do you mind just explaining what patriarchy is for those of us who might not, you know, those of our audience who might not be familiar? Just because, I mean, you have feminists in feminist back in studies.
You know, excuse me if I stumble a little bit, but you know, a patriarchal society is one in which the, you know, it's been a while since I've been in academia.
That's okay, of
but
course.
The in which sort of, you know, the family line and and let's say the power will go more through the male side, right? So the family line is counted from the male, and the inheritance is from the male side of the family. And I want to say, you know, this, it's quite broad in terms of how those societies have lived. You know, it's very, you know, for instance, North America is very different, right? There were matriarchal societies. There were societies that had maybe a more equal power distribution or different kind of roles in which women and men had different forms of power. But, you know, sort of, let's say, this patriarchal belt, we do have, you know, we see in various ways how women's bodies are become sort of the center of sort of a sort of sacred kind of way of representing, you know, the culture as pure. Also,
it becomes a playground. It becomes a playground where male politics could unfold itself, let's say.
And I just wanted to say that historically we tend to attribute this to the start of agriculture, and
Sure.
that's where, you know, the roles tended to become more segregated in terms of
Sure.
men working the fields and women working in the home, and
Sure.
that, you know, gradually that played out
So,
into certain ways of, you know, how women were kept to the home.
sure. There's a history of that, of course, and it's well documented. And you know, I'm completely in agreement with you. Now, do you believe in the notion of liberation? In other words, did you find liberation, you know, through your searching to, okay, let me phrase it differently.
This is a big, this is a
So
big
this is
question.
okay. So because this is, I mean, this is like an orient, you know, this is kind of an orientalist vision of the world. You know, let's say people like Iranian Canadian, especially Iranian women, they're oppressed in their home country, and then when they come to Canada, they find liberation. So they become all of a sudden liberated women. So that's the dominant narrative. You know, how did that pan out for you in your experience?
There's a lot of layers to this, and thank you
Yes.
for sort of you know, giving enough of a prompt to
And it's personal, you know, this is all, we all have our own personal experiences. So
yes.
I want to gear it towards your experience.
Let's talk about that. I think I hinted at it with a previous story about how I told, you know, I stopped wearing the hijab, and then I noticed that if I talked about this to certain white people, let's say, you know, I got an approval for, oh, good for you, for, I guess, you know, being liberated and rejecting those notion, you know, those what is perceived as an oppressive structure. And, you know, contrast this with, you know, the other stories I just told you about, you know, how I felt oppressed during my childhood.
Yes.
I started wearing the hijab, you know, sort of through my own accord. You know, it's hard to say, you know, as a young person, you know, I started wearing it at maybe 7 years old, 9 years old. You know, 9 years old is when I sort of committed to it, right? But then I was still wearing t-shirts. We had picture day. There was another girl in my class who wore the hijab, and she took it off for picture day. So I said, oh, I'm going to take it off for picture day too, right? So at this point in time, you know, the child doesn't fully understand the, you know, they're sort of playing. It's a, you talked about a playground before. This is a playground of culture in which a child has a, you know, should have a chance to play with, right? I think it's
Learning.
important to be exposed to sort of different cultures and practices, right? And be able to play with that, right? But, you know, when it came to a certain age, certain things became a little bit more strict, right? And although I felt that I had taken that as a choice, it seemed that going the other way didn't seem to be met with approval, right? From my parents.
Yes.
You know, it is complicated, but I, you know, I fully want to reject the notion that anyone can tell me whether I, you know, that how I dress is oppressive based on their outside view. Because, you know, there are plenty of Muslim women who wear the hijab by choice. And I don't want to make it like, you know, just because my experience and my life trajectory led me to take certain decisions for myself, it doesn't automatically imply that everyone who hasn't had that trajectory in their life is oppressed, right?
Exactly.
And I don't speak for other, you know, Muslim women. I don't speak for Iranian women. I don't, you know, I don't speak for anybody. My experience is, you know, is unique. And, you know, who are you? Not yourself, but like as any outsider, who are you to tell me that, you know, what choices I should make, what my identity is, what, you know, so I don't So when you said, do you believe in the notion of liberation? I think, you know, everyone kind of has to find liberation for themselves in how they feel right in the world. You know, I think, you know, I don't want to reject that some notion of liberation can and should exist, but as you were talking about Orientalism, this is applied specifically to you know, Muslim women as a how do we say, you know,
Tool of control.
it's I'm right, I'm not talking about, it's in the other direction, right?
Yes.
The many people in the West who have accepted that ideology of the West,
Yes.
the, you know, Western liberal values or whatever,
Sure.
what have you,
Yes.
as the end all be all, which I disagree with.
It's almost another type of control. It's
It's
almost like,
another, yeah, so there's, you know, in Quebec now, you cannot,
wear the hijab.
did they pass
I
that law,
believe so.
as a teacher? Right.
Yes.
So, you know, now there's a teaching shortage. There's a shortage of teachers right now. And you know, it's absolutely ridiculous, but it's another, yeah, it's another tool of control. So, you know, again, you know, we have that, you know, which, who, I don't know who is doing it, but I think the ICC used that logo where there's one woman with a chador holding the hand of one
Yes,
woman
correct.
without hijab, and they are saying we are stronger together, right? So,
I mean, it's as if it, that symbol somehow means liberation. If somebody takes off the hijab,
yeah,
I
yeah,
personally,
it's and it's quite upsetting to me. For a moment in time, I was following what's her name, the lady in France with the curly hair,
Mrs.
Massif,
Oh, no,
Massif
Massey
Ahlinejad.
Ali. Oh,
I was following her for a moment, but then I realized she was really, like, really kind of embedded in those French politics of anti, you know, anti-hijab, anti, you know, this identity of that Muslim women want to present, you know, want to be
she
in the
was
world.
promoting her own politics.
Yeah. So
Of course, yeah. And so I agree with you. And I don't want to take much more of your time. I feel like we can talk easily for another hour, but I know you have to go as
Yeah,
well.
we can do another podcast episode maybe.
I know, it's very interesting because oftentimes your lived experience is worth hundreds of books. Reading books. Your lived experience and all of this. I think you're at part of a point of your life where you have, you're able to manage multiple com or complexities within identity. Part of, and correct me if I'm wrong, me, I'm a Muslim, I identify as a Muslim man. I'm a Muslim man. I follow the religion of Islam. But I cater towards, the way I cater towards my own worldview somehow. It has to fit within my perspective, within my paradigm. And I feel like you're in a similar situation. You're able to fit these different, on a face value, conflicting identities, but you're able to fit them well within within your life, within your experience, so that you're able to live. You're comfortable almost with paradoxes.
Well, I've lived with my paradoxes my entire life, right? So
Yeah.
at some point I had to just find, you know, just weaving my way through there, you know.
Yeah. It seems like you started questioning everything, even maybe gender, religion,
Yeah.
your sense of belonging in the world. And I suppose this could be a topic for a future podcast. There is a lesson here to be learned for many people who are, who might identify as Iranian Canadians living in Canada. And as you know, here in Canada, among young people, but I think especially among Iranian Canadians who are either born in Canada or growing up mostly in Canada, there's a lot of mental health issues, you know, crisis of identity, you know, because it's very difficult. These identities, when we say Iranian Canadian, gender identity, even Muslim religious identity, these are really complex complex terms, and they have very complex politics surrounding them. You know, and as a young person, it's very hard often to, you know, integrate them effectively in your upbringing, in yourself, and navigating them. So give us your final view. You know, how can we overcome these, let's say, potentially conflicting identities, and how can we integrate them into becoming a more complete person?
Sure. So as you were speaking, I was thinking, you know, it really saddens me to see many young Iranians arriving in Canada now, as adults, and completely rejecting their Iranian identities and trying very hard to assimilate into the existing, into the Iranian, you know, sorry, not the Iranian, but the Canadian society, which, you know, without all the immigrant identities and of course the indigenous identities that, you know, that the land was stolen from, what is Canada? You know, you know, I'm able to sympathize a little bit because I have, you know, heard other stories about certain other immigrant groups who needed to assimilate for very valid reasons, you know. In particular, I'm thinking about the Japanese during the World War II, right? There were internment camps in the U.S. There were, you know, similar things, I'm sure, going on in Canada. Sometimes, you know, sometimes for your own safety, it's necessary to hide.
Yeah, of course. Yes. And we do that all the time. That's a natural instinct to adopt customs.
I wonder, you know, and, you know, these people that I encountered, you know, many, you know, sort of recently arrived students, right? I wonder what will happen after several years. I don't know, because some of them, you know, will tend to adopt a racist politics. You know, I overheard one time in the cafeteria, I think at Concordia once, there had been some kind of, you know, threat. I don't think it ended up, you know, being Muslim, thank God, but, like, you know, there was some kind of bomb threat, you know, and they were, you know, some concern and evacuating the buildings. And then, you know, at some point I remember hearing some conversation of a couple of Iranian guys, and this one is funny, we didn't talk about it, but a lot of people don't perceive me as being Iranian on first encounter. They tend to think I'm French for some reason, but, you know, you know, I'm pretty white passing, right? So I use this term. I never in my wildest dreams would want to be white. You know, I identify as a person of color, which, you know, I've had, you know, some people who were maybe less educated on the topic with me, oh, you think you're a person of color, you know, you look white to me, right? But, you know, I was even once shocked to listening to an Iranian woman darker than myself, and that was actually in my thesis interview, but she said, I was the only white person at my school. And I was like, excuse me? I was the only white, you were the only white, you know, I would never dream of identifying as white. It's not, I didn't even grow up that way. I didn't have that privilege, you know, but I do have a white passing privilege. So I tend to pass around, and people don't know I'm Iranian, and they'll say things in Farsi and I'll overhear them, and then I'll get to not attack them, but correct them, in fact. You know, it may not be well received sometimes, but, you know, at least I try. When I feel like I need to say something, I try to say something. But, you know, these people were saying, you know, that they didn't understand why certain Muslims would arrive in Canada and continue to, you know,
yeah.
practice because
of course.
We are trying to escape that oppressive regime. And,
sure.
you know, unfortunately, I think that some people lack that self-awareness, not only self-awareness, but awareness of the environment that you and I know is incredibly racist and harmful and oppressive towards people who don't, you know, who don't for one reason or another fit into that narrow expectation of, you know, in Quebec, it's pretty strong in terms
sure,
of
yeah.
like the secular, what, you know, quote, impositions of
sure.
what you should be to be a person in this supposedly free society, right? So, you know, they play right into the hand of the racist politics that is being
yes.
And then we have people who feel emboldened to attack our mosques and, you know,
yes.
write graffiti on
sure.
You know, the mosques and the cultural centers. You know, this was quite recent. There are actual examples that actually got me quite, actually quite motivated me, right? I had already been in contact with, you know, the board and some members of the board and I was aware of the work of the Congress. But, you know, people will, there was a case of a woman, Iranian hijabi woman who was attacked because her husband said something that was, you know, interpreted in a certain way politically that, and they were attacking her publicly on LinkedIn by posting the name of Mahsa Amini on her profile. What does she, like, what does this poor woman have to do with Mahsa Amini, right? Who was, unfortunately, you know, lost her life. And, you know, the Congress is doing some, you know, memorial kind of service. But, you know, that was not at the hands of this woman
right.
who is living
right.
in Canada, trying
yes.
to
right.
live
right.
her life. And because she's wearing a hijab,
yes, yes.
people well, feel emboldened to attack her. So I would hope that people see and come to understand, because it's not just, you know, they are not going to be excluded from the racist politics that they are emboldening in some way.
Sure.
Because it's not, you know, because I'm not wearing the hijab, it doesn't mean that I'm not going to be discriminated against because of my name, because of, you know, maybe certain practices I continue to hold. And, you know, I said I'm quite white passing, so maybe I will not, you know, not tend to be attacked in certain ways. But, you know, many of these Iranians, I'm sorry to say it, but, you know, they may, you know, reject certain aspects of religion, but because of their color of their skin, their accent, they will continue to be discriminated
sure.
against. And, you know, I think it's important for us to recognize that that exists and have solidarity among our groups who, you know, continue to be oppressed and discriminated against in this society.
I think that's a wonderful note to, I guess, to call this a end of our podcast and coming to an end. And, you know, finishing on a note of solidarity, being accepting of other people's struggle and really being there with them in solidarity and in acceptance, and really becoming aware of these systems of oppression that might be more subtle when we're talking about here in Canada, for example. And I think one last thing that we took away from our conversation is the possibility to integrate these seemingly conflicting identities without having to go, without having to discriminate against one versus the other. You don't have to necessarily be Canadian and be in conflict with whatever you were as an Iranian or a Muslim. you can adopt aspects of each identity and integrate them within your own personality. And it seems to me that, you know, this might seem more of a challenge, but in the long run, you know, when you have these reservoirs of identity, these cultural tools, it would give you a far more fascinating insight, like you mentioned, this ethnographic or this anthropological insight, the emic and ethic, the insider and outsider perspective into culture, which would gear you, I think, in my experience, has geared me, and from what I've learned from you, geared you towards social justice. But on that note, Mona, I really want to thank you for being on the podcast. I hope we can continue the conversation in the future. Any final takeaways before we say goodbye?
Thank you so much, Daniel. This has been a pleasure. I really enjoyed having this conversation with you. I would say you're a great podcast host, and I hope that we continue to do good work with the ICC, and maybe we'll do another episode. Who knows what the future holds.
Thank you very much, Mona. We'll talk very soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.